This is Dave Vellante, and welcome to the March 1st Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting, where peers discuss challenging problems in the enterprise and sometimes discuss some interesting solutions. If you are not speaking today, please press star 6. Please mute your phones. If you don't have a mute, star 6 mutes it in the system, and then you can press star 6 to unmute. And if you want to participate, we encourage everybody to please do so. This is an interactive call. We welcome your participation, and we definitely want to hear your opinions and your thoughts. The topic today is big data. Is your data warehouse a dinosaur? And Wikibon has done some research recently, and we wanted to share the findings of that research. This is a culmination. We've probably talked to over 40 organizations and individuals around this topic of big data, traditional data warehousing. And so we talked to about a dozen deep IT practitioners around traditional data warehousing, trying to understand some of the problems that they were having, and as well spoke to a number of individuals in this emerging big data space. Companies like Bitly, people from Cloudera, people from places like Greenplum and IBM, doing some really interesting things with a lot of unstructured data that is very dispersed. So big data, as many of you know, or most of you know, is data that's too large to be handled using traditional methods. And originally, search companies like Google and Yahoo came out with techniques to handle this type of data. And others picked up on that, the Hadoop movement in particular, and Doug Cutting and his buddies in his garage out in California created Hadoop and ways to manage largely unstructured, unwieldy, dispersed and often distributed data and actually make sense out of it. And so what we're going to talk about today is the juxtaposition of big data and traditional data warehousing. We're going to share with you some of our findings from that that study that we did, and again, we invite you to follow on at justin.tv. It's justin.tv/wikibon, where we will be presenting some of the results. Let's see, is David Foyer on the phone?
Yes, he is.
Hi, David. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. I think I just did the setup, and let me just elaborate a little bit. Big data is clearly different than traditional data warehousing data, but they are complementary, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. As I said, David, I was just telling the audience, we have talked to about 40...
I had that, don't worry. You don't need to repeat that,
So why don't we start off, David, if you could take us through, and Stu, if you could put up the sort of high-level findings. We've done some economic modeling, we've done a lot of in-depth interviews. David, what are the top takeaways that you learned from this research?
Okay, well, it's great to be here with the community today. And the top findings from the research that we did were, the first one was that data warehouse appliances are well received by the users. They're 15 to 30% lower cost than a roll your own. But going into a little bit more detail, they weren't applicable to everything. There were certain use cases where your roll your own was a lot cheaper. And one important thing is that it needed to be a single SKU. By that, it was updated altogether. The worst case was where people were passing off appliances which were really just a rolled together set of pieces and then thrown over the fence for the users to look after. That wasn't an appliance.
Let me stop you for a second, and I just want to put some context into this. A big catalyst for this study was Oracle Exadata, and as folks know, Oracle and HP originally got together and created an appliance, and then Oracle, after it purchased Sun, starts to jam its own vertical integration and technologies into Exadata, and has been really pushing that. It's got a billion-dollar plus pipeline, et cetera, and it's really disrupted the marketplace. So we wanted to really understand that dynamic and how the appliance piece of the market related to that legacy infrastructure and what David's calling roll your own, basically taking, let's say Oracle or IBM databases, EMC storage, and some other middleware, and creating your own data warehouse. So that's a little bit of context. So go ahead, David.
Thanks. So the second finding was that data warehouses are obviously I/O constrained. That's not any surprise, but universally, I/O loading things, getting things done through the I/O was a constraint. Columnar compression was an important trend to reducing that constraint, and obviously Flash, the use of Flash has exploded as a solution to that. Those are going to make I/O constraints better, but they're not going to be the universal panacea. The next finding is that big data is different from traditional data warehousing, very different. And we're going to talk about the definition a little bit later on. But there's been some interesting observations that I've read that appliances equal big data, and we strongly believe that the whole business premise, the whole driver behind big data is very, very different indeed. The next one about big data is quite simply that big data is driven by the business, not by IT. And it's driven...
David, let's talk about that a little bit. So it's driven by who? It's heads of customer service, senior vice president of retail or customer care. It might be driven by, in a technology company, somebody who's actually trying to monetize big data. Think about LinkedIn actually creating products like LinkedIn Skills. And the like. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It is looking for a solution to a business problem, a solution that they could not solve with their traditional data warehousing, and looking at big data analytics and completely different ways of looking for data, finding data, and trying to extract value from that data. Yeah. And we're going to look at this in a little bit more detail a couple of slides further on. But the case study that we had was very, very interesting. In a situation where big data analytics were relevant, the comparison about against trying to do this with a traditional data warehouse setup with an appliance was more than four times faster and less than a third of the cost. Very, very big differences indeed where it was appropriate. And the last finding is that big data and data warehouses are complementary. We'll show that that they feed each other. Some of the data for big data is going to come from data warehouses. And if it gets established as a firm business process, then there's no reason why it shouldn't go back into the data warehouse in the fullness of time. But in terms of operation and technology, they're very, very different indeed.
All right, so that's good. That's a good high-level overview, David. Thank you for that. And we're going to go into a much more detail here. As I said, we talked to a dozen IT practitioners, really data warehouse heavies, and we got some great feedback from those guys. I'll just share some of it with you. One customer told us, you know, our data warehouse is like a snake swallowing a basketball. Another said, we're constantly chasing the chips. What produces the latest and greatest chip? We bring it in. You know, speed is everything to us. Others talked about the convenience of appliances and the allure of appliances, but also the constraints that they bring. One customer complained that appliances don't scale, for instance, storage independent of compute, and so you got to buy them in chunks. And that, while that's convenient, it oftentimes is costly. If there's a regulatory change, for example, and you need more storage to accommodate that change, oftentimes they had to bring in more compute. So there's an interesting dynamic going on between the appliance space, which has a lot of momentum behind it, and many believe, I think even IBM has publicly said that they feel that over 70% of the new installations, traditional data warehouses, are going to be appliance-based. But there's still some benefits to doing roll your own. So, and of course, a lot of this is driven by Exadata. Let me just stop. If you're not on mute, if you could mute your phone, we'd really appreciate it. There's some background noise, and if you don't have a mute button, *6 would mute the phone. Thank you. So, David, let's talk a little bit about Exadata. It's a disruptive force in the industry. We all know, we're watching what Oracle is doing and how it's using vertical integration and integration as a weapon. Talk a little bit about Exadata and what the impact of Exadata and Exalogic are in this space.
Sure. Just to let you know, that these slides that I'm talking about are up. I don't know whether you mentioned that.
Up on justin.tv/wikibon. And are they up on the Wikibon site now?
Yes, they are as well. Yes.
Okay, so if you go to wikibon.org, you'll see them under the professional alerts, I believe. So yeah.
I've just put them into the introduction for the. For the
invitation,
yes.
Okay, great. So if you just let people know where they are, for those who can't follow on TV, if you go to wikibon.org and look at Peer Insights, it's on the left-hand side underneath the pane of people, you'll see Peer Insights, our most current Peer Insight, March 1st Peer Insight, Big Data Explosion is your data warehouse, a dinosaur. Just click on that and you'll see the slides that David's referring to. Okay, go ahead, David.
Excellent. Okay, so what is the impact of Exadata and Exalogic on the marketplace? Well, first of all, Oracle's strategy is very clear. It's to own the whole stack, from the hypervisor all the way through to the application itself. So they've got the Oracle VM as a hypervisor. They have their own operating system. They have the database components of it, and they're putting in the management pieces of that, and also with the objective of bringing in the applications themselves to run as a complete stack. And that's a very powerful disruptive force to the industry. Within the stack, they're optimizing function, moving function around, particularly in columnar compression and the use of the storage grid. I wouldn't want to overemphasize this. It's something that they can do. They can make some benefits here. But when we looked in more detail, most of these benefits are available to people without the stack. You can use most of this stuff, but there's definitely potential for the future to integrate things in a more efficient way. The third point I wanted to make is that they're offering this as a single SKU. In other words, that updates come as a single update completely tested across all of the components. And that's a really important part of the value proposition for an appliance. It becomes then cheaper. It's more expensive, obviously, to purchase, but it becomes cheaper to maintain it because it's a single appliance. One of the interesting things about this is that you have to give it to somebody in the organization to actually use. And it's got to be a logical person. Often we found that in the appliances that the database group often get it, and they need to be able to manage the whole lot. And that can cause some significant organizational friction if there are other groups that are used to owning or taking part in that function.
So David, let me explore that a little bit. With you. So basically,
sure.
We're talking about the convenience of the single SKU, particularly from the standpoint of things like software patches and OS upgrades and the like, an appliance model makes that very convenient. Now, some of the practitioners warned us, and for the users on the call, we want to sort of bring this up, that what was happening was that in some cases, systems integrators, the large SIs and VARs would come to the clients and say, look, we can create essentially an appliance for you, and we'll give you the best of both worlds. We'll do a roll your own, but we'll create this appliance and we'll give it to you as quote unquote a single SKU. And they would build that, sort of quasi appliance and then hand it over to the customer, which was great, to get started, simplified the time to deployment. However, down the road, the onus was on the customer to do all that patching and changing and sort of integration testing and/or, sort of outsource that to the systems integrator, and several practitioners indicated that was problematic. And the second point that David mentioned is the whole organizational issue. So when you have this role your own, picture, you know, a large financial institution that's been around with IT infrastructure for 40 or 50 years, and they've got mainframes and open systems and Windows and now, you know, PDAs and other devices. Their data warehouse infrastructure is a mess, and that legacy infrastructure is extremely complicated, and they've got, you know, inputs from storage people and database people and middleware people and application people, and who owns that single box is an issue that practitioners need to resolve and think about. So, you know, oftentimes we forget about those organizational issues. So I just wanted to add some color to that, David.
Excellent. Thanks very much indeed. And then just finishing off on the points about Exadata, of course, from a business point of view, it's the mother of all lock-ins. It really protects Oracle's revenue stream going forward. Once a buy-in into this, this is going to be a very, very long-term commitment. That's goodness, and it's concern. It's obviously goodness from the point of view of lower overall costs, etc. It's a concern that going forward, particularly the database cost of this is very, very high indeed. And we mentioned the fact that it's a disruptive force, but I also want to emphasize that it's not a big data solution at all. Big data, by definition, is distributed. It is not highly organized. You do not know what type of data it is going forward. In fact, that's really on the next slide. This is probably a good thing to look at now.
So David, this is Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Why does it have to be distributed?
The basic premise of data warehouses is essentially that everything comes to one place and you move it to that place. The reason why that it is practically going to be distributed is that the cost of moving that data is going to be prohibitively high, because you don't know at the beginning what data you need. You don't know, if you bring it in, it becomes out of date anyway. You may not want that data later on. It may have been no use to bring it in. It's going to be very, very dynamic in choosing that. And it's much, much more efficient to move the logic to the data rather than have to bring the data to the logic.
So let me add a little bit more color to that, if I may. And as I mentioned before, we've talked to over 40 individuals about this, many of in the big data space, particularly with our partners at SiliconANGLE and what we did at Hadoop World and what we just did at Strata. Let me give you the Mike Olson answer to that, Nick. Mike Olson's the CEO of Cloudera, a startup who really is to Hadoop what Red Hat is to Linux. And Mike Olson was on theCUBE at the Hadoop World, and what he said is, back in the day, if you had a big, you know, data problem, what you would do is you'd go out and you would buy the biggest Spark or HP Unix server that you could find, and then with the money that was left over, you'd buy Oracle licenses. And then that box became your data temple. The problem became, and we heard this from the practitioners, is that the data was growing faster than the technologies, the chips, and the storages of the IO's ability to keep up. And so when Google had all this data for search, rather than try to build a data temple in a traditional RDBMS, it said, let's develop MapReduce, leave the data where it is in a distributed fashion. Instead of bringing terabytes of data to the data temple, let's bring 5 megabytes of code to the data in a distributed fashion and operate on it in parallel. And that made the task much more manageable, in fact, manageable. And we heard this, obviously, from the big data folks, from Google, from Yahoo, which really, you know, sort of sponsored or underwrote the whole Hadoop movement. We also heard it from more traditional companies, like we heard from Abhi Mehta, who at the time was with Bank of America, and how they are building data factories using this concept of distributed data. Now, the last point I wanted to make, and we heard this again from Abhi Mehta, is his point was, this is game-changing. Why? Because in the case of fraud detection, they were able to essentially go from 6 months down to literally 6 minutes in terms of the ability to detect fraud. And the key was the ability to operate on the entire data set. In other words, no sampling. Normally what you would do in those types of situations, you take statistical samples. Well, big data techniques and things like Hadoop allow you to operate on the entire data set, and essentially what Avi told us is sampling is effectively dead. So that's sort of a lead-in to big data. We sort of touched on, David, some of those definitions. Stu, if you'd bring up the definition of big data, and we can talk about this, you know, in the last half hour. We've got one or two more slides to present. But we thought we'd put some structure around this notion of big data and try to put a definition. David Floyer put up a great article around enterprise big data definitions and giving a lot of examples. But David, why don't you quickly take us through what you've come up with here?
Yeah, so big data then, a definition though, is very large distributed aggregations of loosely structured data. Often it's incomplete and inaccessible. Some parts of it are inaccessible. So we're talking about obviously large amounts, petabytes, exabytes of data, millions and billions of people that it's referencing, billions and trillions of records, and then we've got real case studies showing those numbers, loosely structured and usually distributed. Even if it's distributed, it could be within the organization, but often and increasingly there are sources of data outside the organization, outside the firewall. They tend to be flat schemas with a relatively few complex interrelationships. The interrelationships come from probabilistic inference rather than as part of the schema. They're often involving timestamp events. It's often of great interest to know what is happening over time. Often it's incomplete data, and there are the connections between the data elements are, as I said, probabilistically inferred as opposed to part of the data schema. So applications in general that involve big data can be either transactional, things like Facebook or PhotoBox or a whole number of others, and different databases are usually applicable there, or analytic, for example, applications like ClickFox, which we'll refer to later on, or Merced, or a whole number of other applications of that sort. So these definitions shows how very different it is from the traditional warehouse, which is structured, is all available in one place, comes from a set of well-known applications. So very, very different type of problem that it's solving and very different type of technology that is optimal for it.
Yeah, now ClickFox is an interesting case, and we'll talk about those guys in a minute in terms of Marco Pacelli's been a guest on theCUBE a number of times. His whole rap is, look, if you don't have, you know, an application to take advantage of all this data, you don't have anything. But before we go there, I want to put some caveats out on this definition. So a lot of people don't like the term big data. In fact, at the Strata conference, they didn't use the term big data. They talked about making data work. Now, of course, at the GigaOM conference, you know, big data is hot. It's a good keyword, and a lot of people are using that. For Wikibon has used that extensively, but a lot of people don't like the term because, you know, what's big data for me might not be big data for you, and everybody's got some form of large data sets that they have to operate on. Other practitioners and other particularly folks in the academic community told us on theCUBE that, you know, they didn't like the term because they think that big data is overkill. You don't need Hadoop to solve a lot of these problems. And so that came up a lot. And my co-host, John Furrier, who I believe is on the call, you know, might have some other perspectives on here. John, are you on?
Yeah.
You know, why is it that, for instance, I know Cloudera doesn't like the term big data. Why is that?
Well, I just commented on the chat room. I think big data is a great hype buzzword that everyone can get behind. So it's more of a, to me, big data is a marketing buzzword to talk about the unstructured movement. And Hadoop seems to be the open source trend around that because it came from big web properties like Yahoo, Facebook, Google, Twitter. These big companies are using Hadoop, Hive, HBase, all these big technologies to handle unstructured data. and it's metaphorically big. But, you know, big data to me is like Web 2.0. It's this elusive positioning. It's not really specific. In general, the feedback amongst all the people I talk to, CEOs down to alpha tech geeks in the IT community, is that it's all about data is everything. You know, it's all about not just big data, it's data everything. So it's all data. The interesting caveat is that it's the diversity of data that's the most interesting dynamic. It's not about siloed data classes. They're all kind of intermingled together. So it's very elusive. The term is very hypish. It's good marketing for the movement of big data. And so I think it's not about big data per se, and I think that's going to be more of a title of a conference, title of, you know, kind of the category.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. And now I just put up a blog this morning called Customer Care in the Era of Big Data. And if you think about what David was saying earlier, it's the line of business driving this. It's the senior vice president of customer care or customer service or the head of retail in a banking operation. We all know, we all have the stories, and this is sort of the point of the blog, of you call up a call center and you get into IVR hell and it's just a disaster. You're on the phone for 40 minutes. And we're actually quite unsophisticated in terms of the way in which we route customers through the various touch points of our organization. So we mentioned QuickFox. What QuickFox does is they've actually got a software application that gathers all those touch points and analyzes them, puts them into a database. We actually met them through GreenPlum. They were doing some work with GreenPlum, and we've got a case study on that that we want to share with you, which is quite interesting. But I would call it a quasi-big data application, right, Dave? It's not a Hadoop application, but it operates on a lot of data. And it has clear business value. So why don't you take us through the case study, which is a customer care example. What we're going to show you is comparing a big data type of application in different architectures. And then we'll talk a little bit about, so the reverse, why, for instance, Exadata doesn't fit well into a big data application, and then the reverse, why some of these massively parallel architectures don't necessarily fit well into a traditional data warehousing environment. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. So in this particular case, we're talking about an organization that has a whole number of traditional main billing applications. This actually was in a telecommunications, mobile telecommunications environment. So all of the billing applications are there, all of the traditional applications are there, and there's a lot of data from that, from the data warehouse, if you like, that they could use. But there were also a lot of other applications, the web applications where people came in maybe and touched the organization, or the call centers where they came in, or third parties that were helping them, a whole number of other areas where data was available about the customer experience. So these systems weren't connected in any way. They weren't designed together. They were in different parts of the organization. So the data was distributed within the firewall. In this particular case, it wasn't outside the firewall. It was distributed. There were no common definitions across the different systems. So the challenge was how to pull all these pieces of data together and find out from the customer's point of view what it was looking like. And they knew things were wrong. They knew they wanted to find out what was wrong with their processes, what was wrong with things in general, and how they could put them right. And that in itself is a very interesting story, which we could spend a whole lot of time on.
So let me set up this chart. This is the value of big data analytics. And again, it's very important to note that this is a particular type of use case, right? It's not generally and broadly applicable, as David just described sort of the environment. So on the vertical axis, we've got the cumulative cash flow of a project, and the horizontal axis is time. And what you can see is a big data approach, which is, if I understand it, David, it's a massively parallel architecture, I believe it was GreenPlum and QuickFox and Merced running on top of the infrastructure. And then in the red, you've got a traditional data warehouse appliance. I believe it was either Exadata or maybe it was Teradata. You can correct me there. But the idea here is that the time to value, because you're operating on a massively parallel system with lots of distributed data, versus in the traditional Exadata environment, lots of locking, lots of hierarchy, and lots of traditional sort of legacy infrastructure, the time to load data was substantially less with the sort of newer architectures that are more akin or tuned toward big data. Now the reverse is not true, right? You wouldn't want to use those massively parallel architectures in a traditional data warehouse. So that's the setup, David, if you could sort of correct any mistakes I made and then give us some additional color on that.
I think that's a very good summary. And as you said, the key to this problem is you don't know what the correlations are going to be going in. So your setup of the whole model has to be very interactive. And in this particular case, they used a piece of software called CR-X from Australia to pull it all together. And when they made their first cut at it, it wasn't good enough. They needed to find other ways of getting at this data, looking at the correlations, etc., to set up a very, very large in-memory model as the endpoint of what they were trying to achieve. And because of this iteration, they needed to reload and retry the database all the time. So this is a constant.
That CRX is an ELT.
Yes.
Tool, right? Extract,
yes.
Load, and transform. And it got very high marks from a lot of the practitioners that we talked to. We really don't know that much about it, but it's something that some of the users on the call may want to look into.
Sure. And so the reason why the big data was so much more efficient is that you could load it much faster, you could iterate much faster, and the key of the whole thing was that they could reduce from a yearly project, the traditional year-long project it would take to do it on the warehouse, down to a one-quarter project. So they could complete everything within that quarter, find out what the problem was, and take action. And from a business point of view, that is what caught everybody's attention from the CEO to the senior vice presidents. That was what was driving the expenditure. It happened to be a lot cheaper. It happened to be very much faster, but time was the most important thing for them to be able to make these changes and find out what the problems were with customer experience.
Okay, great. And then the last piece that you want to show here is the sort of relationship between big data and traditional data warehouses. So I guess it helps us answer the question, is your data warehouse a dinosaur? So is your data warehouse a dinosaur, David? Is it extinct?
No, it's certainly it's not a dinosaur, but the potential for the big data analytics or even the big data transactional systems is very, very high, especially in the sort of situations that we talked about. So it's not a dinosaur. You still need a place to put well-structured data from the transactional systems. You'll add to those every day, every month, or every day. You'll still have analytics, which are looking at those on a production basis. And when you can get it to a production basis, it can be made very efficient. But the big it'll put data into the big data analytical environments. The traditional data warehouse will have data there that can be used. The big data, of course, will have many, many more sources of data. Those sources will be inside and outside the organization. It'll be part of the iterative solutions to test and improve models. And that'll be a very different, highly parallel type environment to actually be able to do this sort of thing. But at the end of the day, if Some of those sources of data become more codified and can be built into the applications. They will go back into the traditional data warehouse to improve that over time. And we found that from some of the customers we talked to, that they were doing it initially in the big data type environment and then moving some parts of it back into the traditional data warehouse. So there's complementary, but certainly from a business perspective, the potential value in the big data analytics is very, very high indeed, and the ability to do things quicker without having to predefine everything beforehand.
And now, I want to open it up for discussion. Before I do, let me just sort of make a couple of points and then summarize. And I wanted to bring in one of the comments on the chat stream. Somebody said, big data is driven by the business, not IT heads, says Wikibon. Really, the point was really, I don't know many business heads running MapReduce jobs. And I think that's actually a very fair point. And I think that to clarify there, I think it's worth trying to clarify, and I'll put this out there, is I think that big data is growing up, it's maturing, and we're starting to see big data go mainstream. And I think as it goes mainstream, it's those business heads that are really trying to understand the transformation of the economy from whatever, the physical world or even the e-business world, to one which is really driven by information and data and trying to monetize that data. So I guess that's more of a future-looking statement for the mainstream. Certainly a lot of the Web 2.0 and internet companies are, you know, it's being driven by cool stuff and VC funding. So I think that's a very fair point. I think there's a real schism in the marketplace, that there is, you know, the early big data adopters were trying to solve a problem around unstructured data, particularly search, and that's evolving, and we're starting to see that in companies like LinkedIn and Bitly, where really, truly business people are beginning to look at ways to monetize and add value through that big data and create data products. Increasingly, data will become the product that is sold. So the other thing I wanted to mention is we talked about Exadata really being a catalyst in this market, and I've likened it to an NFL draft. For those of you who can deal with sports analogy, you know, sometimes you'll get a run on a left tackle. Somebody will take the best left tackle, and all of a sudden everybody will start taking left tackles, and we saw that with after Exadata, we saw IBM bought, or EMC bought Greenplum, IBM bought Netezza, HP just bought Vertica. So we've seen a real run on these companies, really hot space. I mean, these companies are small firms, not a lot of revenue going for $300-400 million, so quite impressive valuations. And then sometimes, however, you might overlook a Tom Brady in that draft. And so, you know, it remains to be seen, you know, how that market shakes out. We're seeing some clear differences between so-called big data and traditional data warehousing. And I think, David, that was a very good summary. So thank you for sharing that research with the community. And what I wanted to do now is just open it up for comments, challenges, perspectives that anybody else out there might have. Again, star 6 will unmute your phone. Just chime right in if you have any comments or questions on what you just heard. Anybody?
Dave?
Peter, yeah, please introduce yourself or give us your first name if you're not comfortable giving all your full name.
Dave, this is Peter Daly in Dallas.
Hi, Peter. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to speak with you as well. Interesting topic. Question. The entire topic set seems to me to be associated with kind of quote-unquote online data or active data in some form. I understand it's dispersed. I understand it's in a bunch of potentially different sites and whatnot. I'd like to talk about historic data. My premise is that a lot of firms need to keep data into perpetuity for compliance purposes and for a whole bunch of other purposes. What is the thought on historical data as it comes down to, you know, quote unquote big data? I include historical data as a part of big data, and I don't see that in your definition.
Yeah, that's an interesting point in discussion, so let's talk about that a little bit. And I was going to ask David, you know, where does cloud meet big data? And I think that there's no archiving data or less frequently accessed information. I mean, our research shows that 90% of the data that's out there is goes untouched. That is where cloud meets big data, at least in part. David, any thoughts, or does anybody else have any comments on that?
I've got a. Can you hear me? Okay, I've got a very. It's a, the line is very fuzzy at the moment.
Peter, if you wouldn't mind going back on mute, that might be helpful.
I think that's a very good point. And historical data is has many of the same characteristics, which is that it's loosely structured. It's historical data that may come from many different applications, and you want to look at it across a completely different process than they were originally created for. So I think that big data can be historical. I think the big data can be on the cloud from Facebook or from any of the social media, from Twitter, etc. All of these are potential sources of big data. One of the interesting ones that we had referenced is the use of video to capture information about people, you know, good people, bad people, people coming into your organization, be able to know who is coming in, people who might be detrimental to your organization coming in. So there's a vast amount of data out there. And I think it includes historical, it includes web, it includes video, it includes all sorts of data. And I think the most interesting potential job out there is the one of data scientist, somebody who can help businesses understand these sources of data, the potential in them, and help organizations monetize them.
Dave?
Yep.
Yep. I have a comment on this, John Furrier from SiliconANGLE. I've been speaking with many CEOs and folks around this topic, and an interesting trend I want to share on that point is there's two kind of views of data problem or opportunity, and that is there's a historical perspective, you know, store it, archive it, make it available, query it. And that's a historical, you know, run reports. It's not very time sensitive per se. You know, there are latency issues around how big the data is, but it's very much a historical view, what happened. Right? So that's kind of like a looking in the back, you know, back rear view mirror on that. Now the trend that I see emerging with Hadoop and some of these new technologies is to leverage data in real time. So everyone's talking about real-time web, mobility, and cloud as these big mega trends. And there's a movement towards predictive data modeling. So the data scientists that I talked to are saying, you know, we're now looking at using data that's coming in real time for predictive analysis, where the time horizons for the analysis is more real time, you know, seconds, minutes, days, not weeks, months, years. Dave, you mentioned companies like QuickFox and others who have been using this data model in real time for customer use cases, customer satisfaction, understanding workflow, and things of that nature. So to me, that seems to be a big trend around why the investments in big data is the predictive side of it, so which is different than what traditional folks have been dealing with. I can tell.
Yeah, and you know, that's a good point. I think there's a spectrum of predictive analytics where, you goes from, as you've called them, looking in the rearview mirror, just sort of the historical trend lines. For instance, in the customer care world, sort of the world that QuickFox lives in, if you could actually visualize and quantify the touch points that a customer has on the web, in a kiosk, on the phone with an IVR system, and actually identify the problem areas simply by looking back and finding where they went, and then doing some even lightweight predictive analytics on where they're likely to go. For instance, well, they just 90% of the people who bought this phone called this 800 number because they didn't understand some particular point. You can get that from that 360-degree view that a company like QuickFox can bring. And those are relatively lightweight analytics, but you're right on that when you talk to the people that we talked to at the Strata conference, they're doing really sophisticated analytics. I know IBM is big on this. IBM's kind of betting the company on this whole predictive analytics piece, at least part of the company. And so I think there's a spectrum there that is in the nascent stages that's really emerging, but clearly goes beyond the traditional sort of, you know, Cognos, SAS, SPSS type of environments that we've been used to for the last 20 years. Okay, other comments or thoughts, questions, opinions, insights?
David, this is Burt Lattimore. I wondered if anybody, if you've seen anybody using the big data technologies, the Hadoop type technologies for forensic data analysis. This happens when you're involved in a big court case, that sort of thing. It usually involves, it is historical data, but it usually involves handling many different kinds of data, including unstructured data, and you're looking often for relationships among people, for instance, to identify a fraud, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the themes that we heard at both Strata and Hadoop World and in speaking with some of the practitioners was that a lot of the big data activities are very much industry specific. You'll see the utility industry for, you know, a geological exploration. You're talking about a medical applications. There was one example at Strata recently where there was a contest, I think a $4 million prize for the algorithm that was able to predict which patients were more likely to go into the hospital and would go into the hospital according to some threshold. So a lot of medical applications. You're seeing applications in manufacturing, ways to, you know, improve safety. I think fraud detection, we heard that from Abhi Mehta. So it's very specific use cases and industry cases. And I'm not personally familiar with any, you know, specific forensic analysis, but I suspect that, you know, anywhere there's complicated sets of data, this type of approach is going to apply. Anybody have any specific knowledge of forensics?
There are some very sophisticated use of the data in the UK that was started by the large amount of terrorist activity there, from the use of video data at checkpoints within all large towns and on the highways to be able to monitor car movements, people movements, etc. within that. And that's has been a very, very successful application of video and other data to catch terrorists.
Other thoughts, questions, comments? That one, David, from a user standpoint, we talked about how traditional data analytics and data warehousing is complementary with big data. For the practitioners in the audience, how would you organize this? I mean, you know, it seems to me that traditional data warehousing is very incremental. You know, you're at the end of every month, you're adding maybe, I don't know, whatever, 5-10% more data to the data warehouse, unless there's some kind of, you know, regulatory event or something like that. Whereas big data, you're sort of redoing the analysis every time. It's a completely different mindset. You know, organizationally, where would you put the big data? Should you sort of, you know, create another silo? I mean, we hate silos in IT, but should we create another silo? Should it be driven by the business as a separate silo, or should it be somehow integrated with the traditional data warehouse and data analytics? What are your thoughts on that?
That's a absolutely key question, and I think that it starts off with people in IT that can talk to the correct levels of the business about the opportunities of pulling together data like this. So I think the early movers in this space have been people like ClickFox or Merced, who have come in to the end users and said, we have a way of helping you solve that problem. And from IT's perspective, then they need people within, obviously experts within their particular industry, who can take a broader view of all the applications out there, all the sources of data out there, and start that communication. So that's the first point of contact is being able to talk to the lines of business about the potential. I think from the block and tackle of how you write the Hadoop code or et cetera, I think that then it falls fairly squarely within the IT organization and is part of the application group. And they need to develop those, and they will then define what technology is best suited to that. I think that will evolve over time. But I think the starting point is how do you communicate, how do you define these sort of problems, and in a completely different way than things have been done in the past.
Okay, I've got a little bit of time here. Any other thoughts? In the remaining time, I just want to do a quick scorecard in the enterprise, but anybody have any other comments?
Yeah, this is Peter Gailey again. I have a little different take on the potential siloing of data. My supposition is that data has value, whether it's clean data or not. I look at the massive amounts of data as an example that's being generated by CERN. The value of that data is incalculable, and we don't know and won't know the value of it until it's been manipulated. And it can be manipulated, you know, in 20, 30, 40 years differently as different scientists come up with different suppositions. So my thoughts are that data has value. It should be retained. I kind of always fall back on, hey, are you going to ask me, do I have to ask the right question? Well, if I don't know the right question to ask, then I generally can't do my business, my predictive analytics business issues. So kind of long and short, data should be retained, whether it's siloed or not. Data has value. You may not appreciate and know what the value is now, but it may be of value later when different hypotheses are generated. So that gets back into my comment before about historical data versus online versus transactional data.
Right.
So these are financial decisions, operational decisions, and very, very potential decisions that the business lines, business unit leaders need to make.
Yeah, and we heard a lot. Oftentimes, the hardest part is knowing which questions to ask. And a lot of the practitioners told us that when they were able to load much more data, they started to see patterns and begin to ask questions that they never would have thought of before. So to the point, there's value there that we're going to be able to mine down the road. Last chance for any other questions or comments. I wanted to throw out, was there a question? Sorry. I want to put out there, because we follow the enterprise here, right, at Wikibon. It's a coverage area for us. So here's a, you know, you've got sort of three camps, right? You've got the traditional enterprise guys. You've got the innovators like Cloudera and QuickFox and Membase and Karmasphere. And then you got the big users that are driving a lot of products around big data, Twitter, Google, Yahoo, Facebook, Bitly, and funding a lot of this stuff. But I want to talk about the enterprise players. You got IBM, HP, Oracle, EMC, Cisco, Intel, and Microsoft. And I'm going to put it out there. I want to hear people's reactions. So in terms of the positioning and how well these guys are positioned for this big data trend, we're assuming that, you know, big data, cloud are real. So IBM seems to be very well positioned, particularly in the analytics space. Maybe not so much from the infrastructure side of the house. They're really not really thinking about the big data space. HP, I would have said it was nowhere. Then they go out and buy Vertica. So new CEO, Leo Apotheker, you know, clearly intent on adding software value. Oracle, not necessarily positioned well for big data today with Exadata, although they'll claim it from a marketing standpoint. But Oracle always just buy what it needs. EMC. We'll also do a very good job marketing it, and the Greenplum acquisition puts it right in the heart of this whole big data trend. Cisco, I mentioned Cisco because moving data around the networks, you know, that's what Cisco's all about. Intel, again, massive parallelism, Intel-based architectures. That's why Pat Gelsinger saw Greenplum as so attractive, you know, simple hardware and then put value on top of that in the software. And then Microsoft, don't necessarily see Microsoft, you know, as a giant player in the space, even though they've done some things, like the data market, which is kind of interesting. So I put that out there, you know, as sort of a quick rundown. I wonder if people have any thoughts on that, comments, or would amend those statements in any way, shape, or form. Did y'all agree? You still there?
Yeah, we're here.
All right, good. All right, so I want to thank David Floyer for presenting today. Really appreciate your insights and the hard work that you did on creating this study. I want to thank everybody else who participated, Nick Allen, Peter Gailey, John Furrier, and Burt Lattimore. Appreciate your comments. Just as a reminder, we'll have 6 research notes up by tomorrow or Thursday on this topic, covering user issues and actions. Another reminder is on Wednesday 3-9, we have a big Cube Day here in Marlboro. We've got the CEO of Twin Strata, Nikos. I'm not even going to try to pronounce his last name, but Twin Strata is a cloud data protection provider. And then at 1 o'clock, Brian Reagan, the CMO of Ziotech, is coming in. He's going to talk about VDI. And then at 4:30 on the 9th, next Wednesday, we've got Rob Strickland, who's the former CIO of T-Mobile, who actually helped us develop some of this data, some of the case studies that we saw. So looking forward to that. Appreciate you guys watching today on Justin. Thank you, Justin. Thanks to our friends at SiliconANGLE for participating and all the help that you gave us in gathering this data on theCUBE. And thanks for listening, everybody, and thanks for being a Wikibon member. We'll see you next time.